Hey everyone, quick announcement. Each week I try to bring you an episode to the show that offers something for everyone. It might be a training tip, insight into a world or national champion's life and how they got to where they are, or it might just be talking sports, the shooting sports in particular, for entertainment purposes. At the bottom of each of my episodes, you will find a Koji link to my website where you can find sponsors, links to guests, things of that nature. Currently, there are three sponsors: Laser App, Gun Butter Lubrication, and now Aim Sights Products. I will be putting out a specific episode about Aim Sights and their products. But by using the links provided, you indirectly support the podcast without any additional cost to you. As a matter of fact, you typically save money by following those links. They'll give you a discount, and then they'll send a little bit my way just to kind of help with the podcast. The discount link for Hoist is included. However, I don't get anything from Hoist, but I believe in their product and I feel it's a hydration product for you, which I highly recommend, especially shooting matches in the summertime where it's hot and humid. Now, if you don't use any of the products listed, there is still a way to support the podcast by using the tip button on the Koji link. It surely isn't required. None of this is required, but it is greatly appreciated. I'm trying to make the podcast as professional as possible, which does take time, a lot of time, and money. You can use the link to email me as well, whether you have suggestions for guests or whatever, comments, feedback. Regardless of whether you use a sponsor link or not, I still hope you enjoy the show. Please like it, share it, and give it a 5-star rating if you're so inclined. Thanks.
So I get Scout Sniper Platoon. We come right before coming back. I, as a joke, put in a PAR, personnel action request, to request to go to SOI East instead of going on recruiting duty, knowing it's going to be flat out denied. No, you're going on recruiting duty. Right. One day I come in, on my cot is a piece of paper, and it goes S&M, SAF Sergeant Alisea, BD 3441-0369. Approved for SOI East combat instructor duty. And I'm like, okay, somebody's messing with me. So I go to the first sergeant. I'm like, first sergeant, I was like, you messing with me? He goes, no, it came back approved. I was like, no, I'm going on recruiting duty. This is a joke. He goes, I don't know. He goes, I don't know how it happened, but it happened. So I got out of recruiting duty and went to, became an 8531, a combat instructor, and enjoyed the time there too.
Nice.
Yep. Now, I kept getting lucky.
For people listening, S&M is not sadomasochism. It's subject name Marine. So, I just want to clear that up. Like, yeah. S&M, what? Yeah. This yeah, podcast just took a hard left turn.
Well, when I push the button here, the whips, the chains, and all that comes out.
There you go. Oh, all right. So you spend 2 years there, I take it then?
No, I did 3 years.
Okay.
With SOI, but I did, my first four, lucky me, they needed people to go to MCT. And the way they did it was the first 7 infantrymen alphabetically went to Marine combat training. And Alisea, I was at the top of the list, right? So, hey, Staff Sergeant, you're going to, MCT. I'm like, this is some bull crap. It's always bad initially and it winds up getting good, but right. I go to hotel company. I was second in my class. The honor grad was a guy that had already did SOI West prior. So I took that as a win. I'm like, hey, this guy's already done this. He knew exactly what to expect.
Right.
And I was right. I lost 2 points on drill because I marched the platoon through a puddle after the instructor said no more marching through the puddle, but I was off to the side gaming it, doing it in my head, and didn't get the word
didn't
that
hear
you couldn't
it, right.
go through the puddle anymore. And so I lost 2 points for that, but with the test and all that, me and him were just killing it. And I'm like, ah, whatever, we're good. So we actually both wound up going to MCT. And shortly thereafter, I found out I got selected for gunny. Right after that, it was right after my daughter was born too. So it's like, yeah, everything's lining up. And I had a good time, but then I got selected to go to AIT to be a platoon sergeant's course instructor, which was, it changed the name to infantry unit leader's course at the time. So I get there with the honor grad who was also one of the instructors there. And immediately we have to rewrite the entire curriculum. They're like, hey, we got to rewrite all this. So that's how I started off in AIT. My first class was just a observation class where you watch how they conduct the class. And one of the students was my old corporal from 3-6 Scout Sniper Platoon. He was a corporal when I got to the fleet. Shepherd was his name, Corporal Shepherd. Big, huge, muscle, black dude. And he was the funniest dude ever. And now I'm a gunny and he's a staff sergeant. And I'm like, wait, what happened here? You were a corporal.
We just reverse roles.
Yeah, I was a PFC and a Lance Corporal when you were a corporal. And he was one of my students for the course. Well, that's cool. And then from there, they started the Combat Hunter program, or the experiments for Combat Hunter. And I was selected as the sniper reconnaissance candidate for it because they wanted different backgrounds. And I went to California for the three experiments. And I don't know if you call it, I understudied for Greg Williams, which was the human behavior pattern recognition analysis guy. So he taught me everything he knew in his 30, 40 years of experience with that, which of course he's forgotten more than I ever learned, but I really, really got into that. And then I was the staff NCOIC for the Combat Hunter program on SOI East. I started it.
Can you explain what exactly that was?
So Combat Hunter, they were taking all the data they were getting from Iraq and why some people were doing very well there and other people weren't doing well. And what they discovered was, you know, it's human behavior. People that knew how to read the population were doing much better than the people that were not good at it. So when they started bringing the people back and interviewing and doing questionnaires and all that, they discovered that, hey, the guys from like L.A. and Detroit and Atlanta, you know, the guys from the inner city were doing very, very well. Yeah, because they had the street smarts. And some of the country boys were doing well, the ones that paid attention because of their hunting background and learning, hey, deer, where do you hunt a deer? Where there's food and where there's water. And then come October, November time frame when the rut's going, you don't have to hunt the water and the food. Look for the does and you'll find the bucks because they're trying to breed the does. So they had that in their head. They couldn't articulate it, but they just figured out, hey, the bad guys tend to do this. Bad guys tend to hang out with other bad guys. Bad guys tend to hang out at locations like that. Hey, when I walk into the village market, every week up until this week, it stayed bustling. You know, people were coming up to us. They were talking to us. But the last two times we went there, the people started shying away from us and the crowd started dispersing. So now, hey, something's going on here. Something's up to no good or somebody bad is in the area. So those guys were doing well. And then you had the guys that were obliviously just walking into that and stepping on IEDs and walking into an ambush. So when they took all that data, they said, here's what we need. He goes, the Marines, they don't know how to use their optics, especially thermals and night vision. And the RCO, the rifle combat optic, the ACOG, they weren't doing very well with them. So I was the optics guy for the program. And I had to write classes on everything we were doing. And then, of course, like I said, understudying with Greg on his portion. But we did combat tracking. We did optics. We did the human behavior portion of it. And we just combined it and made a course. And it was called Combat Hunter. And then the Marines were attending that course before deploying in country and then being interviewed when they came back to see what the improvement was. And during the experiment, the first thing I saw was a corporal who had been to Iraq, I believe, twice at that point. We were up in Talega doing a patrolling package, and we would have scenarios set up with role players and all that good stuff. And this corporal was trying to point out something that he could see to his team. Problem is, his PEC-2 at the time was on the left side of his rifle. which, if you remember, on a 203, that's where the sling keeper was.
Yeah.
So the sling was actually blocking the laser beam. So the laser was hitting the sling. And he's like, something's wrong with my laser. And, of course, you know, I got my PBF-14s, and I look over, and I see this huge bloom on the front of his rifle. And I'm like – so I walk up to him. I'm like, hey, you said you've been in country twice. And he's like, yeah. I go, did you use your PEC-2 at all on deployment? He's like, yeah, all the time. I go, and right now you can't tell me that why your laser isn't working. I said, because if you look at the light, you can see that the light is on, showing that the laser is firing at that point. And I go, okay, how about you look at your sling? Like, point your rifle down and look down. And that's when he saw the bloom. And he's like, oh. I said, so you need to put that PEC on the other side or put it on top, you know? So that was two combat deployments, and he had no idea that he had that laser on the wrong side of his weapon. Then, of course, they couldn't use thermals for crap. You know, you tell a Marine, hey, when can you use the thermal? And everybody's like, oh, at nighttime, you know, so you can see the people. I was like, you know, you can use thermal during the day.
24 hours
like,
a day.
No. I go, it's a thermal. It's not night vision. It's a thermal. So then we started showing them how you can actually detect different things, how you can tell if somebody's wearing a body armor or they're wearing a S vest underneath their clothes. And we were doing it with role players. We were showing them the difference between a female, where a female runs hot and where a male runs hot. So you can tell from a distance if a person's a male or a female. If they're dressed like a female, they should be running hot in a female area of their anatomy, not on the male part. So all of a sudden we start doing this training, and I mean, leaps and bounds. They're like, they're coming in, can't even barely turn on a PAS 13 and put the battery in correctly. At the end of that, they were like experts with that thing. So they were all going in country, and instead of the PAS 13 being a thing that you put on the bottom of the 7-ton so you can stand on it and clear the rail, they were actually employing that even during the daytime to detect suicide bombers and people with weapons that were being hidden on their person.
Wow.
Yep.
Now, here's a little side note. The first time I saw thermal imagers, they brought them to 2nd Recon Battalion for the first time ever in 1989. Mm-hmm. And we were playing with them. They were huge, though. I mean, huge. And we were playing around with them then, and it was perfect weather because we were out at Onslow Beach. It was raining. It was foggy. So you only had like 75 yards that you could see and nothing beyond that. So it was cool looking through the thermal imagers because you could see the vehicles driving away. They would disappear into the fog, but you could still see them with the thermal imagers, which was, and then we'd go and look at the parking lot and you could see which cars had been driven, which ones hadn't because of the different thermal readings. And then it was at the sniper school. That's where in the advanced course where we were doing other things to learn how to defeat them. So that was a whole other class, but that was awesome. But anyway, this thing was huge. I took it to, my team was selected to take it on deployment to Puerto Rico, Isla Viegas, when we could go there.
Yep.
And I had another guy in my team waterproof it. And I waterproofed my camera, my $400 Nikon camera to take. And we got inserted on rubber boat. The thermal imager, everything in the boat was completely submerged. We had so much weight in our boat that everything was submerged. We were completely soaking wet. We get everything on land. My camera survived because I waterproofed it well. The guy who waterproofed the thermal imager didn't. And it was dead. $45,000 piece of equipment dead from salt water. Yeah, I was like, uh-oh. I never saw another thermal imager again when I was there, but I don't think anybody else did either. I think they were like, we got to do a better job at, you know, making these things more waterproof for the Marines.
Yep.
So, but that was fun. That was my first intro.
We actually used some in Somalia. The Army gave us, it was an old Blazer. And it was called a Nighthawk system. And they had the camera in the back, the bed of the vehicle. And what we would do is at night, we'd go out to an OP. And, you know, we'd drive out normally as the Blazer. But when you were set up and it was dark, you pop that camera system. And the back would open up like that. And a camera would come out. and you had a display right in the center of the dash, and you're just spanning just across the area you were looking. The stuff
like a
I
joystick?
Saw at night and smile. Yeah, you had a little joystick, and you just pan this camera back and forth. You could get distance, direction, everything you needed. You could see things that you don't ever want to see in a thermal camera in Somalia, especially in Somalia.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Toilet paper is a commodity there, but dirt was plentiful, and I saw dirt being used to do cleaning, which made no sense to me, but saw it all the time.
It's a little abrasive.
Well, you know.
Well, it's a little dirt between friends. I'm out of dirt. Can you pass some?
Yeah. Give me some of that sand over there.
Oh, my goodness. So you ended up retiring in what year?
2013.
Okay. At what point did you find competition? Was it after you got out?
Oh, no. Yeah. Well after I got out. Actually, when I retired, I was getting big into gas guns at that point. ARs, and I had just built a couple of them in 6.5 Grendel.
For fun.
It was something I wanted to try out. I did have a 223, and a buddy of mine that was in 3.6 Scout Sniper Platoon, me, Jeff Fox, he's like, hey, he's like, how about you, he wanted me to test some ear pro for him, actually, because he had started up a team called Jade Precision, and what they were doing is they were consulting with some thermal companies, ear pro companies, you know, gun company across the board, just trying to make some extra money to support his shooting habit. And he's like, how about you test some ear pro for me and tell me what you think? So they shipped me some ear pro in the ear, electronic ear pro. And I took it out hunting because I was hunting every day and doing all kinds of crazy things out in North Carolina. And I did a review, a buddy review on Facebook. Hey guys, check out, you know, if you're looking for ear pro, check these things out. And I told them what they did for me. And the manufacturer saw my post. So they get up with Jeff and they go, hey, ask him if he wants to come to SHOT Show to work the booth, you know, to sit in the booth and talk to people. So at the time I wasn't working. I'm like, well, the people that suckered me out of the Marine Corps, I retired for the job. 3 years later, the job kind of went away because they just stopped pursuing the leads we were giving them. They made the money they wanted to make, and now they wanted to move on. So I sitting on the couch doing nothing. And I go to SHOT Show. I do the show. Had a great time. And then my buddy's like, hey, you should come out to a match and check it out. So me and another buddy jumped in my truck, and we drove 12 hours to Kentucky. And I watched my buddy Jeff Fox shoot a PRS match. It's called the Long Range Shooting Experience up at, what was it called? Cave something. I can't remember. Up in Kentucky. First shot went downrange. I was hooked. I'm like, all right, dude, where do I get a gun? You know, where do I get the equipment I need to do this? Shortly thereafter, probably September of that year, I walk into my local gun shop. And there's a full Masterpiece Arms 6.5 Creed build sitting on the counter, which made no sense because it's a hunting fishing store, nothing to do with precision rifle. And I'm like, well, how much is that gun? And they go, well, you know, it was kind of given to us because how good we're doing in sales. And they told us to sell it for whatever we want, but it can't be cheaper than this number here. And of course, I'm still not working, so it's a long shot that I would even buy this gun. And they go, but we're doing a 1 year same as cash on this rifle right now. And so it took two trips going back and forth and kind of playing with this thing. And of course, they're telling me, hey, man, some other snipers came out here because I knew the guy at the store. He's like, and they're looking at it and they're talking about buying it. And I'm like, so you said 1 year same as cash? Yeah. I go, all right, put me in for it right now. They go back, they do their credit check. They're like, hey, you're good. You can get it. I'm like, and they go, and we'll drop it down to this price. And I was like, all right, sold. You twisted my arm.
Bonus.
So I walked home with that, or I drove home with that and sent the picture to Jeff. He's like, all right, you know, throw that scope from your other gun and put it on there, and you're ready to shoot a a two-day match up in Ohio not too long thereafter. So my first two-day PRS match was up in Ohio for September 11th weekend. So actually, I bought that rifle in August sometime. So first shots I sent down range were actually to zero it the day before the match.
So I guess they had a zero range there that you could zero it.
We went to a local range by his house.
Okay.
Zeroed it at 100, and then I went and shot the two-day match Saturday and Sunday.
Wow. Now, I take it the Kentucky match was probably Mammoth Cave?
Mammoth Cave. That's it. Yep, that's it. Yep.
All right, that makes sense. So that's interesting. You zero it the day before at 100 yards, but, I mean, PRS, I'm
no
assuming...
No data, no nothing.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to get at. So how did you have some estimations for your come-ups?
I had a Kestrel. I had a Kestrel that the team gave me when they asked me to jump aboard. So I had a Kestrel. Never knew at the time that, hey, you have to true up the data and all that. So I'm just like, hey, it says I need to do 3.4. I didn't hit I shot terribly. But I had a blast doing it for 2 days. You know, I'm like, yep.
Okay.
Jumped on a plane and headed back home. I was like, I'm hooked. I'm hooked. And ever since then, it's been nonstop.
Oh, that's funny. That's hilarious. And by truing it, he means actually shooting it and determining the differences between what the Kestrel's saying, what the gun does, and so on and so forth. Okay. Wow. And now I look at your social media and you have pictures of 4 guns, 5 guns, 6 guns. I mean, you've got guns coming out the wazoo.
3 of these guys got 2 in that 6-dasher, 1 in 22 Creedmoor, which will be my hog hunting gun. But I broke it in during a match. And I have a 25x47 barrel actually being spun up as we speak, because he texted me right before the podcast started that, hey, I'm doing your barrel right now. And I ordered projectiles and brass yesterday. So I'm going to try that. That might be my slightly heavier hunting caliber for out here, but I'm also going to shoot it at matches, especially ones that I know are going to be super windy.
Okay, So what kind of velocity are you do you expect to get out of that?
I'm 2900 with a 135 Berger hybrid. Yeah. But the BC is ridiculous higher than a 105 Berger.
Okay. So how many 6.5? So do you still have that original 6.5 Creed rifle?
Oh, no. So that was a, what was it? It was the Kelbley Atlas Tactical Action, which I love. I actually sold it to a buddy of mine who still has it. I shot it factory ammo for the first year and a half. Went through 2 barrels with it, and then I sold it. I had the TL3s already because I had gotten a cert from that Rainer's match up in Ohio, and switched to Dasher in beginning of 2019. Late 2018 is when I went to Dasher and haven't looked back.
And you did that strictly for wind purposes?
That recoil reduction, being able to see my impacts.
Okay.
And back then, I didn't shoot as heavy a rifle. Back then, I think the heaviest my rifle ever was about 16.5 pounds, which was 2 pounds heavier than an M40, which I thought was way too heavy back then. And now I'm shooting a 23.5, 24-pound rifle, and I'm like, you know, if it wasn't so heavy, I would add a little more weight to it. But
My
22s, my 22s are almost as heavy as my centerfires.
Wow. All right. So I want to go back first off. Why did you choose 6.5 Grendel over 6.5 Creed?
Oh, for gas guns, I wanted the AR-15 platform, not the AR-10 platform. So I went with the Grendel.
Okay.
And I was reading a lot of good stuff about it, how it could keep up with the bigger calibers at 1,000. I'm like, that sounds kind of cool. Let's do it. Yeah, no, it definitely does not. But it was definitely a fun rifle. They're both sitting here still. They're fun. But, give me a bolt gun every time now.
All right. So now you said you put 2 barrels on your 6.5 Creed. What my question is what type of barrel life were you getting out of the 6.5 Creed versus your 6 Dasher?
I got on my first factory barrel, I got about 2,200 rounds. I actually went to Gap Grind and I had my buddies, my ammo got shipped in to my job, and I was actually working in Virginia at the time, covering one of our locations in Virginia. Ammo got delivered to my store in North Carolina. So a buddy of mine, Marsoc guy, he picked up my ammo, my rifle, and he zeroed it for me. And him and another guy were like, dude, he goes, your barrel's done. He goes, we're getting like an inch and a half at best right now.
Oh, wow.
So I'm like, okay, yeah. I said, so my barrel's done. And now I'm going to Gap Grind with a shot out barrel, and actually did very, very well. Besides the thousand, nine, a thousand, where it started getting wonky and I would just keep falling off left and right, then left and right, I did very, very well. And it was probably my highest placing ever at Gap Grind, was with that shot out barrel. But then I
Okay.
went to a new barrel. Gray Sloan over at Swift Creek Rifles spun me up another barrel, Hawk Hill. And normally 25, 2,600 rounds out of a 6.5 Creed. And I was running it hot. I was running a 6.5, H4350, 43 and a half grain,
Okay.
130 grain Burger Hybrid at, oh, it was like 2,980 with Lapua brass and water safe. I would dump the magazine in a bucket of water, take it out, load it in the gun, and just rapid fire all 10 rounds. Never had an issue with it. But
Okay.
of course, that's definitely a little spicy on the barrel, especially with that much 4350. And then that's when I went to the Dasher.
And what type of barrel life are you getting out of your Dasher?
I'd normally pull them at 2,500 just because I don't want them
Oh,
to die
okay.
during the middle of a match. But I
Okay.
got tons of friends that tell me they're getting 3 to 3,500 before they start to see the accuracy or velocity fall off. I just don't want to risk it during a match.
Yeah, I mean, that's no different than changing the battery on your red dot sight every year. You just don't want it to die, so you change
When I
it.
need it, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Now I wrote down, you mentioned that the barrel started getting burned out and you were getting MOA accuracy at best. Now, when you design a load for your gun, what's your accuracy point? Are you looking at a half MOA? What are you
Oh
looking
God,
at?
yeah. If my rifle is shooting a half, it's shooting that's me. It's a bad day for me. 'Cause normally they're just it's a knot. Just they're all going in the same hole or maybe making that hole a little bit bigger. But just getting one after the other through the same hole, I'm not a group shooter at all. And my eyes are going too, so it's like I start pulling it and just making that hole bigger and bigger. But I like to go, okay, let me hold it a little bit to the left. The bullet should go a little bit more to the left. Hey, it went a little bit more to the left, so we're good. But 4/10, 3/10 is usually what I'm capable of. But I know the gun is more accurate than that because I can give it to buddies and they'll go out there and just punch them in the same hole repeatedly.
And I ask because when I designed the load for that 6.5 behind me, I got about 32.32 MOA. So, I looked at it as like almost like what you're saying. I'm like, I know that I have a human error. So I need to get this group size as small as I can to give me as much room for error as possible. Is that what you how you look at it as well?
I know the rifle will always outshoot me. So as long as it's getting a half or better, I know it's going to do everything I need it to do in PRS. Like yesterday, I shot terribly. Wrong data, you name it, I did it wrong. But we get up to the long range stage and it was 2 minute and 1 minute target. So if you hit the 2 minute, then you engage the 1 minute. And we started at 1,000 and came back to 620. So 1,987, 620, and I cleaned it. So I'm like, okay, there's nothing wrong with the rifle. It's definitely
It's
me. As
just
long as I
me.
got the wind right, I should be good. But when you put the wrong data and you're off by 4/10 at 400 and you're missing low, but to me, my eye is going, hey, that was off left a little bit. Okay, no, that was off right. And then I go to the next target, and I'm taking the wind that I think I need for that one and throwing it in there. And now I'm missing off left, right, and I'm going, okay, so now I need a little bit less over there. You're like, okay. And then you come back to this one, do it again. And the whole time it was vertical. And I didn't figure it out until after the match was over. And I'm like, hey, dude, I got on the barricade. I said spot. And even the spotter was going, left, right. And then I was like, screw it. I'm going prone. 400-yard target, prone, miss. Two-tenths left, center, two-tenths right. I couldn't touch this target. And then all of a sudden somebody goes, what's your data? And I go, 1-1. He goes, at 400? I'm like, yeah. And I was like, oh, my God. I'm like, no, it's not. It's 1-6. Wow. So I pull out my Kestrel, 159.
Oh, wow.
1-6, go back to the target, bang. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. And it was a 12-round stage, and disastrous. But whenever it's something like that, I know it's me. This is always going to perform.
Right.
Ammo I make is, yeah, I'm using all the best reloading equipment. If the rifle is missing, it's because it's me. It's not the rifle.
Man, in 92, I think it was 92, I took the rifle, the sniper rifle assigned to me in our cage at Quantico. Mm-hmm. And I took it out, put on my leather coat. I put a sling on that sucker. Yep. And I was shooting 168s at 1,000 in any rifle, any sight match. And I was bringing one of the school sniper rifles out there. And with the 10-power unirdle scope.
Yep.
And wouldn't you know it, if you remember, the fine tune was opposite direction of the normal turret. Wouldn't you know it, I'm like, okay, I fired two siders. I turn around. I'm like, I'm going for score. I make my adjustment. First shot out the bottom, an 8. And I'm like, what in the world? I looked up, and I'm like, I turned the turret the wrong way.
Yeah.
I was like, mother of God, that would have been a perfect shot, dead center, but it was directly, and I mean, you couldn't draw a straighter line from the middle of the X down to this thing. And I was like, so, I mean, I feel your pain. Yeah. We've all done it. So, yeah, I ended up winning my classification, even with dropping an 8 out the bottom.
Well, never anything wrong with that.
No, there isn't, but you're like, what I could have been.
Yep.
It's all good.
Yeah, wait. It's always a long drive home when you mess something up. You're going, I can't believe I did that. Yeah. If I didn't do that, you know, you get the results when you get home. You're like, oh, I won the match. But I can't tell you how many matches I've lost in the last stage where, you know, when I do the points, I'm like, oh, I was in the lead. And then I shank it and only get a 3 or 5 on the last stage and lose by 3 or 4 points. You're like, no.
Yeah.
It happens.
Terrible feeling. It does happen.
Yep.
It is what it is. All right. So now you seem to be doing 22 NRL.
Yep. PRS and NRL.
Okay. So you are doing both equally amount or?
NRL. I don't like regular NRL. I do NRL 22X. Which is similar to PRS. It's not okay, the so fixed, you know, 100-yard range only and doing the monthly course of fire. This the match director has the option to do whatever he wants, and they're going to be held on ranges that are longer, like normal PRS or center fire ranges.
So on a 22 NRLX or 22X NRL, I'm not sure exactly how you say it, what's the maximum range they typically go out to?
I've shot out to 400 on NRLX matches.
And what type of holdover what's the minute? What's the difference between 100-yard and 400-yard? How much you have to come up?
So at 100, I'm usually 1.7, 1.8 mils.
Okay.
At 400, it's, let's see, 300 is 13 and change. 400 is usually right at 20, I believe, if I remember correctly. I don't shoot 400 that often, but 20 or just over 20 mils.
Okay. So for those
so
people
it's about an 18 mil difference. Yeah.
Yeah. But for those people listening, 1 mil is 3.6 minutes of angle. So if you take 20 and multiply that by 3.6, you're looking at like 72 minutes of angle from 100 to 400 yards. That's huge. Now, what is the likelihood? Now, obviously, your weapon is designed for it, your rifle and your scope. But when you're shooting at 400 yards, when you start adding in wind, what's the percentage of first round hits on that?
Depends on target size. A lot of times at 400, it's going to be relatively generous.
Okay.
But yeah, you get a, you know, like a 18 by 18 or 24 by 24, you're still going to miss it a lot. Just because you look at that bullet hard enough and you're going to blow it off target at 400 yards with a 22.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been here locally at 50 yards holding 1.2 mils of wind at 50 yards. Damn. And then there's been times that I'm at 400 and I'm holding straight up. So you just never know what you're going to get until you get out there. But I think the most I've ever held is four and a half mils of wind for, wow, you know, like right at 300.
Man, I'm still waiting for them to start a 17 caliber.
Yeah.
/ NRL. Man, that caliber is a friggin' tack driver.
Yeah, that's fun.
Yeah, it is. I bought a rifle for my son like when he was 10. He's 23 now. And that is still probably of the 22s, the 308, the Creed, all of them. That's probably still my favorite rifle because out to about 150 yards, I mean, that thing is just an absolute tack driver.
You can get a Voodoo in 17.
Can you really?
Yeah, Mach 17, Mach 2. You know, the one that's based off the 22 long rifle. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Wow.
And if you have a gunsmith, you can get a barrel made in whatever you want. As long as it's in the bolt face, you're good. It's just getting the magazines to feed it. So you would be using a, you know, Voodoo type magazine, or hell, you get a CZ or any of them, get it rebarreled, and it should work because it is a 22 casing.
Okay. Very interesting.
He's like, oh, we have options here.
Now, I mentioned earlier that we were going to talk about 22 Creed. That's what I want to talk about now. You have one for your hunting. You say it's going to be your hog gun. I feel like out to 4 or 5, maybe even 600 yards, 22 Creed might be a decent deer gun if you have a clean shot on it.
I've been using Dasher, like I said, since 18 or 19 season for hunting, and I've never had a deer take more than, you know, maybe 20 yards. They've all dropped. So I don't see any difference with the 22 Creed because I'll be running it faster also.
Right.
And it's only, you know, 20 grains lighter. I agree. Right. I think it'll be a good round, but I'm not big into the long range hunting. You know, although I love long range shooting, I'm not a fan of the long range hunting that I see on TV.
Me either.
And, you know, no. Too many wounded animals are coming out of that. On a deer, I would probably keep it inside of 300, but a hog, man, a hog or a coyote, I'm not too worried about them. Sounds mean, but I think if I put a bullet in one of them, they're not going to have a good day because they're relatively small size. It's probably still going to kill them. A deer, you can definitely wound. And although I like shooting deer, I do enjoy, I think they're a great animal, and I don't want to cause it undue pain.
Yeah, I hear you. And I only bring that up because, you know, I look at, like you, I look at max range of being 300 because if your gun can shoot MOA and you can hold MOA, well, you're talking about a 3-inch diameter circle at 300 yards. You can put that round where you need it. An issue. So that's why I bring it up, is just because if it can do that at out to 5, then, you know, if you're shooting 2 or 3, all that added foot pounds of power is just going to make that entrance and exit wound that much greater. I feel like it's still a very good low recoil hunting round.
Oh, it's fun.
So what are you finding with your 22 Creed now?
Well, I just started shooting it. Literally just got the barrel a few months ago, and I shot the one match just to break in the barrel. So I haven't shot anything with it yet until later in the season when I go hunting. But it's still speeding up, actually. I got it to 3,000 with a what I think is a mild load, because I compared it to other people's loads, and they're shooting much more powder than I am. And I'm already at right at 3,000 right now in a 21-inch barrel. And they're shooting 26s and 27s, and I'm like, oh, man, this thing, I'm kind of happy where this thing is going, because I am going to up the charge some and see what it does. But okay. I was hoping for 3,000 is all I was hoping for with a 85.5 burger. And I got people telling me, they're like, oh, no, you're gonna blow past that like it's nothing. So if I get 31, just makes me that much happier.
Yeah, especially if you can do it with the same powder load. But now, what are you finding for accuracy?
Oh God, it's a knot. It's just like the dasher is. They're just going into the same hole. We're slightly making it bigger.
Very nice. And price for ammo, comparing the 22 Creed, the dasher, and 6.5 Creed, where does it sit price wise?
I haven't shot 6.5 Creedmoor in years, and I know, you know, with the regular prices that have gone up so much, I'd never, besides the first year and a half, I never shot factory ammo again. So everything is based off of reloading prices, which at the end of the day, we know is not necessarily cheaper. You used to be able to get more ammo for the same amount of money. Now you're almost at that 1-to-1 right now. That's the same price, because primers have gone up at a ridiculous rate. Mm-hmm. Powder's gone up at a ridiculous rate. The bullets that I want to shoot, everybody else is shooting, so it's almost impossible to find them. So now you're starting to run into the ridiculous rate for them too. I would say they're at this point are probably all right at about the same point price-wise.
Okay.
Although I can get the 85.5 burger at a pretty good price. Now I'm shooting 43.50. Lot more powder than I'm shooting out of my dasher, so that's increasing the price a little bit per round.
Equaling
they're
it
all
out.
Using the same primer, yeah, so it's all equaling it out. It's no longer the why you shoot what you shoot, because almost everything's the same price nowadays.
Right. What type of barrel life are you hoping to get out of it?
If I get 2,000, I'm happy. If I get 1,800, I'm happy. 1,500, because it's a hunt rifle. It's not going to be a match rifle. So that would take me many, many, many years to shoot out.
Right. Okay. Now, do you see yourself shooting any more matches with it till it reaches that point where it's right
now?
No,
I'm probably almost right there now. Like I said, I went to my buddy's range. I shot 30 rounds just to verify data. And from when I started to when I finished, I had gained like 70 or 80 feet per second at that point. So I'm assuming that I'm most of the way climbed up to where it's going to be. And now it's probably just going to start to stabilize or maybe gain a little bit more. I'm still under 200 rounds right now.
Oh, okay. All right. You got a lot left on that thing then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. And I did what I broke my cardinal rule. I didn't write down my question when I was thinking about it. I had a follow up and it is gone. Now, have you, I had Phil Vallejo on, I guess about a year and a half ago now, and he's gotten big into the NRL Hunter. Have you looked at that at all?
Yes. I got friends here that are trying to convince me to do it, or not only NRL Hunter or Steel Safari is the other one. They've been trying to get me to do. And my problem with that is that it would require a totally different kind of rifle, a different caliber, and I just didn't want to invest in it.
Even with NRL?
Because I know I would be addicted. I know I would.
Okay. So you think even with NRL Hunter, you'd have to have a new rifle, new caliber?
Yeah, you have to make weight and also a power factor. Mm. So the dasher isn't making the cut. Yeah. So I would have to shoot 6.5 Creed with heavies or something bigger.
I did not know that. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. And I had not heard of Steel Safari, so that one's new to me. I take it that's even bigger game then.
That was the original, like walking around. What they call it? Locate, range, engage is what they call it. So you know, close you get the position. They brief you. They go, hey, left lateral limit, right lateral limit, and then they go, you're on the clock. And now you gotta locate the target, get the distance, engage them, and hope you actually hit.
So locate, close with, and destroy.
Yeah, well, not quite. You don't get to close the range,
right? That's a Marine Corps thing.
I'm calling artillery anyway, so that way they have no idea where I'm at.
All right, so you actually have to put your observation skills to work.
Correct.
Okay.
I've shot a reduced version called the Squirrel Safari that a buddy of mine runs, and we do it with rimfire. And you walk around the property, you get to locate the spot, you know, you got spray paint on the ground, left, right. You got 5 minutes to go. You start looking, and all the targets are squirrels, and they're freaking tiny. And it'll be hiding them in the trees, you know, in the shadows, and you're just finding, lazing, getting your data, and then, hey, I'm almost out of time. I got to engage you, get at least one or two points. And I've done, not great. I think I've shot fourth place at every one that I've done.
Okay, not out of four, though, right?
No. Oh, God, no. This is, you know, 30, 40 shooters.
Oh, so it's still pretty good, just.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right. All right, so let's talk optics.
Yep.
I've got a whole bunch of stuff down here. What do you, now, actually, let me back up before we get into that. So I take it, as it looks, you're a sponsored shooter.
I used to be more sponsored, a lot less sponsored now with Jade kind of cutting ties with some of the sponsors, but yeah, you could call it sponsored, yes.
Okay. So I don't know if you have an optic sponsor.
Oh, God, no.
Okay. So we can have a candid conversation.
Yes.
Okay. It's all going to be just generic talk, so it doesn't really matter. But at the same time, I didn't know if maybe, you know, we're going to have to talk about a certain one. It does matter, actually. With comparing PRS to 22X NRL, do you use different magnification scopes with those?
So all four of my scopes right now are zero compromise optics, 5-27. All four of them. And three are on center fires. Yep. Three are on center fires and one's on my rim fire.
All right. Now, 5-27. That 27 seems like an odd number. Normally it's like 5-25 or 5-30.
Yep.
Okay.
So it's a multiplication factor is what you look. So 6-18 is, you know, right. Like 3X. So, right. 5-27 being a 5.5X.
Okay. All right. Now, what size objective lens are you running on those things?
These are 56.
Okay. So pretty good field of view out of that too then.
56 objective and a 36 millimeter main tube. So
now, why a 30?
Bigger than the majority.
Yeah, that is much bigger actually. So why a 36?
That's just what Zico went with. Okay. I don't know why they did the things they did, but majority of the manufacturers are 34. And then you got the occasional 35, like the original Vortex, Razor, Gen 1. And then I believe the loopholes right now are 35.
I'm having, Ilya Koshkin?
No.
He's considered the Dark Lord of Optics. He's an optical physicist.
Okay.
I am having him on this Thursday to record an episode. So I will be asking him.
Oh, nice.
Why.
Okay.
Yeah. So that'll be interesting because I've got two pages of notes. I've listened to several podcasts that he's been on. He's got a YouTube channel. So I've been going through that and I have like two pages of notes of all kinds of questions I have. So that is actually going to be one of them. Now, do you, it sounds like you run mill. Everything mill?
Mill. Yep, correct. None of that Marine Corps MOA mill crap.
Now, what made you choose? Because I still love MOA over mill. But what's your reasoning for you to choose mill?
I don't want to be dialing all day long. Especially understandable. In 22 where, you know, you have a lot of drop. And it's funny, you know, I'm just, you know, and I watch my buddies in mills and they're like, hey, somebody give me some help. Yeah, no, I'm not playing that game. I'll lose that slight accuracy advantage to being able to get the shot off much, much quicker.
Okay, that's funny. That is hysterical. That made me giggle. All right, first focal plane or second focal plane?
First focal plane, of course.
I'm a second focal plane guy.
Oh, not for match shooting. That's interesting. Most people, I don't think I've ever seen a second focal plane scope out there yet. Maybe one, just a guy trying it out for the first time. He's using his hunting rifle. Yes, but as far as match rifles, it's always first.
Well, and that's. I mean, okay. Yes, because mine is a combination. It's not just a match rifle. You know what I mean?
Yep, gotcha. Yep.
And I do prefer to magnify the target and not my reticle.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's why I prefer the second focal plane scopes. Illuminated or non-illuminated reticle?
They're all illuminated.
Do you like the illuminated reticle?
I hardly ever use it, but I like being able to if I need it.
On your competition gun, or which do you prefer on competition or hunting?
In competition, I've never, ever, ever illuminated the reticle.
Okay.
But in hunting, I have.
And I get where people would want it there. Here's why I don't like illuminated reticles. You lose elevation in your turret.
Mm-hmm.
It takes up space inside the tube and you lose that travel. I'd rather have the travel than the illumination.
And can I counter that?
Yes, please. That's why saying
it. When in a hunting or match scenario have you maxed out your elevation?
You know, you can say it recently.
Oh, I was going to say that you should probably say it's never happened. Because I have 35 mils of elevation on my scopes. There's no running out. I did run out in New Mexico a couple months ago when I was shooting at a rock that was 2,000 plus yards away, and I needed 26 mils of elevation, and I ran out just short of it. But I'm shooting at a rock. I would never hunt at that range, so I'm not worried about it. In a match, I think the most I've ever gone up to is like 11 mils. So on most of my scopes, that's still on the first revolution. On my newest one, which is this one right here, I got it the 10 mil elevation turret. I'm still going to be within 1 mil of the first revolution. I'm not too worried about it.
Well, and I need to take my gun back out and test a few things and see why I ran out of elevation, because I don't feel I should have.
Where'd you run out?
Well, now it was a few years back, and I haven't shot them since. And I'm trying to right offhand. I cannot remember. I just remember I hit the end of the turret, and I'm like,
traveling.
And I'm like, I should not have reached the end with a 20 MOA mount
scope base. Yeah.
Yeah, scope base. Thank you. Yeah, so it was really weird. So I don't know if I did something to the scope or what the situation was, but just for me personally, if I'm even for like a, as I was looking to get into PRS at the time and then ended up getting into pistol instead for price and cost purposes, I was looking at elevation travel with the different scopes and different things. And I noticed then that there was a big difference between the illuminated and non-illuminated in the difference in travel. And I was like, you know, that could come in handy, that extra travel. And like you, I mean, I've never used the illuminated reticle. So I'm like, why do I need it? I'd rather have the travel over the illumination. So,
well, it's not too many scopes these days where you get the option.
I know.
Because most either come with it or they don't. Some of the loopholes you can, they're new ones, you can get it illuminated or non-illuminated. But with these, it's automatic. You're getting it with it. And you have the option of green and red built in. So it's not just one color. You have both colors. And what I would recommend is if you felt the need for that elevation, just throw some canted rings or a scope mount on top of your 20 MOA base. That way you gain it back.
Yeah. And I'll probably end up looking at something like that if that's what I need to do. Mm. Now, here's something else too. I had never considered this when I started shooting pistol. And then after I started shooting pistol and started doing target focus shooting, I realized, you know, that's how I did all of my shooting in the Marine Corps was with a scope, was target focus, which is why I like the second focal plane, because I'm just focusing on the target and the reticle is really, if you want to say, in the peripheral. I mean, it's in the way.
In the way. Yeah, it's in the way.
But yeah. Right. But I, you know, I'm not looking at the reticle. I'm looking at the target and just moving the reticle where I need it. I feel like whenever I've turned on the illumination, it detracts me from the target. Have you ever turned it on and used that and found that?
No, usually when I turn it on, it's because it's low light and I'm hunting, especially hogs, and they're dark yeah. colored, and that black reticle, just, you lose it. You're like, okay, you lose where's it. The reticle yeah. at? So I turn it on, and all I'm worried about is, you know, usually 99% of my shots on a hog are in the dome. So I'm going for a very specific spot, and I need that well-defined. But I did learn with pistols. I got a Agency Arms Glock build, okay. and I threw the RMR on there because I, you know, my eyes are going. Ever since right yeah. before retirement, my near vision is, and in the last 2 years, has declined rapidly.
Yes.
And when I first started shooting the RMR, because I didn't know how to shoot it correctly, I was always looking at the dot. And I'm like, man, these dots are not round. They're not perfectly round, you know? And I was kind of like bad mouthing them. And then I got on YouTube one day and they're like, you know, shooting with, you know, RMR, red dot sight, RDSs, you know? And I start looking at them and they're like, no, don't focus on the dot. Look at the target. You're going to pick up the dot as you're moving. And sure enough, I go out there, I throw some targets out and I start just presentations and I'm like, oh my God. It is so correct. Look at the target and the dot just comes into view and there it is. But when I was yep. looking for the dot, it was taking me forever to find where I needed yeah. to put it on the target. And only because I jumped on YouTube and looked it up. Had I not known that, I'd be like, oh, RMR is trash, man. The dots aren't clear, this, that. No, I was using the wrong technique.
Yep. And that's what I had to realize. And then I realized, hey, this is like shooting a scoped rifle in a way. Same technique. You stare at the target, not your dot. Because I mean, we don't look through a rifle scope and like, all right, let me get my reticle, and you know, and then you're finding the target and bringing the gun onto the target. So same technique. All right, now I had a or I do I not had in the past I have a Remington 700 PSS 20-inch 308 caliber rifle. Man, I think the trigger was fantastic. If it weren't for a wind shift, I could have cleaned an NRA 600-yard match with it. But I got caught with apparently the guy scoring for me said me and the shooter beside me got caught as we're getting ready to break the shot. The wind changed direction. Changed, yeah. So I ended up getting a 9 at like 2 o'clock with jacket, sling, that type of thing. So NRA shooting. But After that, I got a recall notice, sent my gun in. They changed out my trigger, and the trigger sucks. I don't know if it was the guy who did it or just the new trigger or what. So for someone who actually shoots PRS and shoots 22 NRL and all of that, is there a trigger you can recommend that I should get to put in there to clean that up?
I was heavy into the Trigger Tech Diamonds, but with the new impact that I'm shooting, they don't get along with the diamond too well. They break a lot of them. So I've switched to the Jewel trigger.
Okay.
But Vix and Andy, Jewel, I used to shoot Calvin Elite, Timneys. I've never had a problem with triggers. They all felt fine to me. But I do like the Jewels, especially when you set at a low weight, that I can still touch the trigger without it going off. Whereas when I set my Trigger Tech light, literally as soon as I touch the trigger, it would go off. I'm like, yeah, that's too light for me. And I've watched people do that, and I watched them shoot, and their finger's nowhere near the trigger. They, like, gingerly close the bolt because they don't want that gun to go off. And then their finger's off, and as they're getting it lined up, then I see them just bring their finger back and touch it and torch it off. And I'm like, no, that's not what I want. I want to be able to put my finger on the trigger. If I got to adjust, I can adjust and then send it when I want it to.
Yeah, so I'm not a super light trigger guy. Okay. Yeah, I like to feel the trigger. I like to know what the trigger feels like. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to have to just barely touch it. I'm not shooting bench rest. So that's, you know, if you're shooting bench rest, okay, I get it. But I'm not shooting bench rest, so that to me is way too light. Okay, I'll have to take a look at those then. Well, Ben, that's what I have. Was there anything else we talked about that maybe we need to go back and touch on again, or anything you wanted to touch on before we call this thing quits?
No, I mean, great interview. I enjoyed it. Threw me with those first few questions. I'm like, what book, movie, what? I'm actually prepping. I'm cleaning my Voodoo right now. I won a match on Saturday. Actually won convincingly. I second place guy was 7 points behind me. But I'm cleaning her up because the NRL 22 finale is this weekend in North Carolina.
Ooh. So okay.
I'll be on a plane Thursday to get up with Tony Gemelli. Is going to be picking me up at the airport, and we got an Airbnb, and we shot it together last year, which was my first year shooting NRL finale anyway. And we're hoping to do something good there this year, because last year we both stunk it up. I think I was in 29th, and I think he came in 30-some or 40-something. But this year, I expect us to do better.
Okay. Yeah, I've had Tony on. That was another good conversation.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So he'll talk your ear off.
He's probably and that's talking. Good for a podcast.
And you're not quite, yeah. And you're not no longer on there with him. But, yeah, we actually went down to Florida a couple months ago because we needed our second NRL score in order to qualify for a finale. And the match that was going to be held in Texas got canceled. So I had no second match and no option. So I started looking to see where I could go for relatively cheap to get a second match in. So I was like, hey, dude, let's go to Florida. I know you can get a ticket to Florida relatively cheap. The rest were like Utah and stuff like that. And I'm like, yeah, no. So we went to Florida, flew in Orlando, grabbed the rental, shot down south a couple hours. And we went and shot the match, and I won it. So I got my 200 points that I need to be ranked or tied for first in the league. I think it was like at the time 7 or 8 people that were already with perfect scores. But I wanted to go into the finale with a perfect score. And now the finale is this weekend. And they changed it up because normally NRL is 2-minute par times. And the finale is back to 90 seconds. So it's going to be like I'm shooting East Coast PRS matches, because even here in Texas, a lot of the matches are, or all the matches are 2 minutes, like most of the western half of the country.
Okay. Is that just because of difference in distances or?
No, I from what I've been told, it's because a lot of the matches out here are under field conditions, so you're not shooting off a prop and stuff like that. Plus, the wind's a lot less on the East Coast than it is here in the Central and West Coast, that you were given a little bit more time to, kind of
Okay,
come up with
figure it out.
your strategy while you're shooting and all that. Yep.
Okay. Now, are you going to be at the reunion by chance in August?
The
At
reunion
Quantico?
for
The Scout Sniper Association?
oh, Scout
Or.
Sniper Association? No, I don't think so. No, I have a match. So I got the finale this weekend. Next weekend, I had the Twisted Barrel PRS match in Arkansas. It's their first match ever. And then September or August, I'm in Mississippi for the Magnolia Meltdown. And then in September, I'm in Alabama for the Alabama Precision. So 3 2-day matches in a row, plus NRL finale. So yeah, it's a busy schedule plus work.
Right. Okay. I imagine it's the Magnolia Meltdown because it's in Mississippi in August. Everything's going to melt.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Especially your barrel.
If you don't melt first.
Yeah. I shot it last year. I shot really well, and on day one I was in fourth place. I stunk up day two and dropped down to the 20s, but I saw what I could actually do if I'm doing everything the way I should be doing it. And I gotta keep it going for 2 days instead of doing well on one day and stinking up one day.
Right.
And
Gotcha.
that's the hard part of the matches, is keeping it together for 2 days.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's different when it's just a one day match versus a multiple day match. So,
Oh, yeah.
all right. Well, Ben, I appreciate you coming on. We're going to have to do this again.
All right. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Until next time.
Don't be a little bitch.
Yeah.